the question to appeal to them in any circumstance of life. He had never experienced such a strange and awful sensation. And what was most agonizing, it was more a sensation than a conception or idea, a direct sensation, the most agonizing of all the sensations he had known in his life. The head clerk began dictating to him the usual form of declaration, that he could not pay, that he undertook to do so at a future date, that he would not leave the town nor sell his property, and so on. "But you can't write. You can hardly hold the pen," observed the head clerk, looking with curiosity at Raskolnikov. "Are you ill?"
"Yes, I am giddy. Go on."
"That's all. Sign it." The head clerk took the paper and turned to attend to others. Raskolnikov gave back the pen. But instead of getting up and going away, he put his elbows on the table and pressed his head in his hands. He felt as if a nail were being driven into his skull. A strange idea suddenly occurred to him: to get up at once, to go up to Nikodim Fomitch and tell him everything that had happened yesterday, and then to go with him to his lodgings and to show him the things in the hole in the corner. The impulse was so strong that he got up from his seat to carry it out. "Hadn't I better think a minute?" flashed through his mind. "No, better cast off the burden without thinking." But all at once he stood still, rooted to the spot. Nikodim Fomitch was talking eagerly with Ilya Petrovitch, and the words reached him.
"It's impossible. They'll both be released. To begin with, the whole story contradicts itself. Why should they have called the porter, if it had been their doing? To inform against themselves? Or as a blind? No, that would be too cunning. Besides, Pestryakov, the student, was seen at the gate by both the porters and a woman as he went in. He was walking with three friends, who left him only at the gate, and he asked the porters to direct him in the presence of the friends. Now, would he have asked his way if he had been going with such a purpose? As for Koch, he spent half an hour at the silversmith's below before he went up to the old woman, and he left him at exactly 7:45. Now, just consider.
But excuse me, how do you explain this contradiction? They state themselves that they knocked and the door was locked. Yet 3 minutes later, when they went up with the porter, it turned out the door was unfastened.
That's just it. The murderer must have been there and bolted himself in. And they'd have caught him for a certainty if Koch had not been an ass and gone to look for the porter, too. He must have seized the interval to get downstairs and slip by them somehow. Koch keeps crossing himself and saying, 'If I had been there, he would have jumped out and killed me with his axe.' He's going to have a Thanksgiving service."
"And no one saw the murderer?"
"They might well not see him. The house is a regular Noah's Ark," said the head clerk, who was listening.
"It's clear, quite clear," Nikodim Fomitch repeated warmly.
"No, it is anything but clear," Ilya Petrovitch maintained.
Raskolnikov picked up his hat and walked towards the door, but he didn't reach it. When he recovered consciousness, he found himself sitting in a chair, supported by someone on the right side, while someone else was standing on the left, holding a yellowish glass filled with yellow water, and Nikodim Fomitch standing before him, looking intently at him. He got up from the chair.
"What's this? Are you ill?" Nikodim Fomitch asked, rather sharply.
"He could hardly hold his pen when he was signing,"
said the head clerk, settling back in his place and taking up his work again.
"Have you been ill long?"
cried Ilya Petrovitch from his place, where he too was looking through papers. He had, of course, come to look at the sick man when he fainted, but retired at once when he recovered.
"Since yesterday,"
muttered Raskolnikov in reply.
"Did you go out yesterday?"
"Yes."
"Though you were ill?"
"Yes."
"At what time?"
"About 7.
"And where did you go, may I ask?"
"Along the street."
"Short and clear."
Raskolnikov, white as a handkerchief, had answered sharply, jerkily, without dropping his black, feverish eyes before Ilya Petrovitch's stare.
He can scarcely stand upright, and you—" Nikodim Fomitch was beginning. "No matter," Ilya Petrovitch pronounced rather peculiarly.
Nikodim Fomitch would have made some further protest, but glancing at the head clerk, who was looking very hard at him, he didn't speak. There was a sudden silence. It was strange.
"Very well, then," concluded Ilya Petrovitch, "we will not detain you."
Raskolnikov went out. He caught the sound of eager conversation on his departure. And above the rest rose the questioning voice of Nikodim Fomitch. In the street his faintness passed off completely.
"A search. There will be a search at once," he repeated to himself, hurrying home. "The brutes, they suspect."
His former terror mastered him completely again. Chapter 2. And what if there has been a search already? What if I find them in my room? But here was his room. Nothing and no one in it. No one had peeped in. Even Nastasya had not touched it. But heavens, how could he have left all those things in the hole? He rushed to the corner, slipped his hand under the paper, pulled the things out, and filled his pockets with them. There were 8 articles in all. 2 little boxes with earrings or something of the sort, he hardly looked to see. Then 4 small leather cases. There was a chain, too, merely wrapped in newspaper, and something else in newspaper that looked like a decoration. He put them all in the different pockets of his overcoat, and the remaining pocket of his trousers, trying to conceal them as much as possible. He took the purse, too. Then he went out of his room, leaving the door open. He walked quickly and resolutely, and though he felt shattered, he had his senses about him. He was afraid of pursuit. He was afraid that in another half hour, another quarter of an hour perhaps, instructions would be issued for his pursuit, and so at all costs he must hide all traces before then. He must clear everything up while he still had some strength, some reasoning power left him. Where was he to go? That had long been settled. Fling them into the canal, and all traces hidden in the water, the thing would be at an end. So he had decided in the night of his delirium, when several times he had had the impulse to get up and go away, to make haste and get rid of it all. But to get rid of it turned out to be a very difficult task. He wandered along the bank of the Ekaterininsky Canal for half an hour or more and looked several times at the steps running down to the water. But he couldn't think of carrying out his plan. Either rafts stood at the steps' edge, and women were washing clothes on them, or boats were moored there, and people were swarming everywhere. Moreover, he could be seen, and noticed from the banks on all sides. It would look suspicious for a man to go down on purpose, stop, and throw something into the water. And what if the boxes were to float instead of sinking? And of course they would. Even as it was, every one he met seemed to stare and look round, as if they had nothing to do but to watch him. Why is it? Or can it be my fancy? He thought. At last, the thought struck him that it might be better to go to the Neva. There were not so many people there. He would be less observed, and it would be more convenient in every way. Above all, it was further off. He wondered how he could have been wandering for a good half hour, worried and anxious in this dangerous part, without thinking of it before. And that half hour he had lost over an irrational plan, simply because he had thought of it in delirium. He had become extremely absent and forgetful, and he was aware of it. He certainly must make haste. He walked towards the Neva along V Prospect, but on the way another idea struck him. Why to the Neva? Would it not be better to go somewhere far off, to the islands again, and there hide the things in some solitary place, in a wood or under a bush, and mark the spot, perhaps? and though he felt incapable of clear judgment, the idea seemed to him a sound one. But he was not destined to go there. For coming out of V Prospect towards the square, he saw on the left a passage leading between two blank walls to a courtyard. On the right hand, the blank, unwhitewashed wall of a four-storied house stretched far into the court. On the left, a wooden hoarding ran parallel with it for 20 paces into the court and then turned sharply to the left. Here was a deserted, fenced-off place where rubbish of different sorts was lying. At the end of the court, the corner of a low, smutty stone shed, apparently part of some workshop, peeped from behind the hoarding. It was probably a carriage builder's or carpenter's shed. The whole place from the entrance was black with coal dust. Here would be the place to throw it, he thought. Not seeing anyone in the yard, he slipped in, and at once saw near the gate a sink, such as is often put in yards where there are many workmen or cab drivers, and on the hoarding above had been scribbled in chalk the time-honored witticism, "Standing here, strictly forbidden." This was all the better, for there would be nothing suspicious about his going in. Here I could throw it all in a heap and get away. Looking round once more, with his hand already in his pocket, he noticed against the outer wall, between the entrance and the sink, a big unhewn stone, weighing perhaps 60 pounds. The other side of the wall was a street. He could hear passers-by, always numerous in that part, but he could not be seen from the entrance unless someone came in from the street, which might well happen indeed. So there was need of haste. He bent down over the stone, seized the top of it firmly in both hands, and using all his strength, turned it over. Under the stone was a small hollow in the ground, and he immediately emptied his pocket into it. The purse lay at the top, and yet the hollow was not filled up. Then he seized the stone again and with one twist turned it back, so that it was in the same position again, though it stood a very little higher. But he scraped the earth about it and pressed it at the edges with his foot. Nothing could be noticed. Then he went out and turned into the square. Again, an intense, almost unbearable joy overwhelmed him for an instant, as it had in the police office. I have buried my tracks. And who can think of looking under that stone? It's been lying there most likely ever since the house was built, and will lie as many years more. And if it were found, who would think of me? It is all over. No clue. And he laughed. Yes. He remembered that he began laughing, a thin, nervous, noiseless laugh, and went on laughing all the time he was crossing the square. But when he reached the K Boulevard, where 2 days before he had come upon that girl, his laughter suddenly ceased. Other ideas crept into his mind. He felt all at once that it would be loathsome to pass that seat on which, after the girl was gone, he had sat and pondered, and that it would be hateful, too, to meet that whiskered policeman to whom he had given the 20 kopecks. Damn him! He walked, looking about him angrily and distractedly. All his ideas now seemed to be circling round some single point, and he felt that there really was such a point, and that now he was left facing that point, and for the first time, indeed, during the last 2 months. Damn it all! He thought suddenly, in a fit of ungovernable fury. If it's begun, then it's begun. Hang the new life. Good Lord, how stupid it is! And what lies I told today! How despicably I fawned upon that wretched Ilya Petrovitch! But that is all folly. What do I care for them all? And my fawning upon them? It's not that at all. It's not that at all. Suddenly he stopped. A new, utterly unexpected and exceedingly simple question perplexed and bitterly confounded him. if it all has really been done deliberately and not idiotically, if I really had a certain and definite object, how is it I did not even glance into the purse and don't know what I had there, for which I have undergone these agonies and have deliberately undertaken this base, filthy, degrading business? And here I wanted at once to throw into the water the purse together with all the things which I had not seen either. How is that? Yes, that was so. That was all so. Yet he had known it all before. And it was not a new question for him, even when it was decided in the night without hesitation and consideration. As though so it must be. As though it could not possibly be otherwise. Yes, he had known it all, and understood it all. It surely had all been settled even yesterday at the moment when he was bending over the box and pulling the jewel cases out of it. Yes, so it was. It is because I am very ill, he decided grimly at last. I have been worrying and fretting myself, and I don't know what I am doing. Yesterday and the day before yesterday, and all this time I have been worrying myself. I shall get well, and I shall not worry. But what if I don't get well at all? Good God, how sick I am of it all! He walked on without resting. He had a terrible longing for some distraction, but he didn't know what to do, what to attempt. A new overwhelming sensation was gaining more and more mastery over him every moment. This was an immeasurable, almost physical, repulsion for everything surrounding him. An obstinate, malignant feeling of hatred. All who met him were loathsome to him. He loathed their faces, their movements, their gestures. If anyone had addressed him, he felt that he might have spat at him or bitten him. He stopped suddenly. On coming out on the bank of the little Neva, near the bridge to Vasilyevsky Ostrov. Why, he lives here, in that house, he thought. Why, I have not come to Razumihin of my own accord. Here, it's the same thing over again. Very interesting to know, though. Have I come on purpose, or have I simply walked here by chance? Never mind. I said the day before yesterday that I would go and see him the day after. Well, and so I will. Besides, I really cannot go further now. He went up to Razumihin's room on the fifth floor. The latter was at home in his garret, busily writing at the moment, and he opened the door himself. It was 4 months since they had seen each other. Razumihin was sitting in a ragged dressing gown, with slippers on his bare feet, unkempt, unshaven, and unwashed. His face showed surprise. "Is it you?" he cried. He looked his comrade up and down, then, after a brief pause, he whistled. "As hard up as all that? My brother, you've done me one better," he added, looking at Raskolnikov's rags. "Come sit down. You're tired, I'm sure." And when he had sunk down on the American leather sofa, which was in even worse condition than his own, Razumihin saw at once that his visitor was ill. "Why, you are seriously ill, do you know that?" He began feeling his pulse. Raskolnikov pulled away his hand. "Never mind," he said. "I have come for this. I have no lessons. I wanted... but I don't want lessons." "You are delirious, you know," Razumihin observed, watching him carefully. "No, I am not." Raskolnikov got up from the sofa. As he had mounted the stairs to Razumihin's, he had not realized that he would be meeting his friend face to face. Now, in a flash, he knew that what he was least of all disposed for at that moment was to be face to face with anyone in the wide world. His spleen rose within him. He almost choked with rage at himself as soon as he crossed Razumihin's threshold.
"Goodbye," he said abruptly, and walked to the door.
"Stop! Stop, you queer fish!"
"I don't want to," said the other, again pulling away his hand.
"Then why the devil have you come? Are you mad or what? Why, this is almost insulting. I won't let you go like that."
"Well, then I came to you because I know no one but you who could help. To begin, because you are kinder than anyone, cleverer, I mean, and can judge. And now I see that I want nothing. Do you hear? Nothing at all. No one's services, no one's sympathy. I am by myself. Alone. Come, that's enough. Leave me alone."
"Stay a minute, you chimney sweep. You are a perfect madman. As you like, for all I care. I have no lessons, you see. And I don't care about that. But there's a bookseller, Cherovimov, and he takes the place of a lesson. I would not exchange him for 5 lessons. He's doing publishing of a kind, and issuing natural science manuals, and what a circulation they have! The very titles are worth the money. You always maintained that I was a fool, but by Jove, my boy, there are greater fools than I am. Now he's setting up for being advanced, not that he has an inkling of anything, but of course I encourage him. Here are 2 sections of the German text. In my opinion, the crudest charlatanism. It discusses the question, is woman a human being? And, of course, triumphantly proves that she is. Cherovimov is going to bring out this work as a contribution to the woman question. I'm translating it. He will expand these 2 sections into 6. We shall make up a gorgeous title, 1/2 page long, and bring it out at 1/2 ruble. It'll do. He pays me 6 rubles the section. It works out to 15 rubles for the job, and I've had 6 already in advance. When we have finished this, we are going to begin a translation about whales, and then some of the dullest scandals out of the 2nd part of Les Confessions we have marked for translation. Somebody has told Cherovimov that Rousseau was a kind of Radishchev. You may be sure I don't contradict him. Hang him. Well, would you like to do the 2nd section of Is Woman a Human Being? If you would, take the German and pens and paper, all those are provided, and take 3 rubles. For as I have had 6 rubles in advance on the whole thing, 3 rubles come to you for your share. And when you have finished the section, there will be another 3 rubles for you. And please don't think I am doing you a service, quite the contrary. As soon as you came in, I saw how you could help me. To begin with, I am weak in spelling, and secondly, I am sometimes utterly adrift in German, so that I make it up as I go along for the most part. The only comfort is that it's bound to be a change for the better. Though who can tell? Maybe it's sometimes for the worse. Will you take it?
Raskolnikov took the German sheets in silence, took the 3 rubles, and without a word went out. Razumihin gazed after him in astonishment. But when Raskolnikov was in the next street, he turned back, mounted the stairs to Razumihin's again, and laying on the table the German article and the 3 rubles, went out again, still without uttering a word.
"Are you raving or what?" Razumihin shouted, roused to fury at last. "What farce is this? You'll drive me crazy, too. What did you come to see me for, damn you?"
"I don't want translation," muttered Raskolnikov from the stairs.
"Then what the devil do you want?"
shouted Razumihin from above.
Raskolnikov continued descending the staircase in silence.
"Hey, there, where are you living?"
No answer.
"Well, confound you, then."
But Raskolnikov was already stepping into the street. On the Nikolaevsky Bridge, he was roused to full consciousness again by an unpleasant incident. A coachman, after shouting at him 2 or 3 times, gave him a violent lash on the back with his whip, for having almost fallen under his horse's hoofs. The lash so infuriated him that he dashed away to the railing. For some unknown reason, he had been walking in the very middle of the bridge in the traffic. He angrily clenched and ground his teeth. He heard laughter, of course.
"Serves him right,"
A pickpocket, I dare say.
Pretending to be drunk for sure, and getting under the wheels on purpose, and you have to answer for him.
It's a regular profession, that's what it is. But while he stood at the railing, still looking angry and bewildered after the retreating carriage, and rubbing his back, he suddenly felt someone thrust money into his hand. He looked. It was an elderly woman in a kerchief and goatskin shoes, with a girl, probably her daughter, wearing a hat and carrying a green parasol.
"Take it, my good man, in Christ's name."
He took it, and they passed on. It was a piece of 20 kopecks. From his dress and appearance, they might well have taken him for a beggar asking alms in the streets. And the gift of the 20 kopecks he doubtless owed to the blow which made them feel sorry for him. He closed his hand on the 20 kopecks, walked on for 10 paces, and turned, facing the Neva, looking towards the palace. The sky was without a cloud, and the water was almost bright blue, which is so rare in the Neva. The cupola of the cathedral, which is seen at its best from the bridge about 20 paces from the chapel, glittered in the sunlight, and in the pure air every ornament on it could be clearly distinguished. The pain from the lash went off, and Raskolnikov forgot about it. One uneasy and not quite definite idea occupied him now completely. He stood still and gazed long and intently into the distance. This spot was especially familiar to him. When he was attending the university, he had hundreds of times, generally on his way home, stood still on this spot, gazed at this truly magnificent spectacle, and almost always marveled at a vague and mysterious emotion it roused in him. It left him strangely cold. This gorgeous picture was for him blank and lifeless. He wondered every time at his somber and enigmatic impression, and, mistrusting himself, put off finding the explanation of it. He vividly recalled those old doubts and perplexities, and it seemed to him that it was no mere chance that he recalled them now. It struck him as strange and grotesque that he should have stopped at the same spot as before, as though he actually imagined he could think the same thoughts, be interested in the same theories and pictures that had interested him so short a time ago. He felt it almost amusing, and yet it wrung his heart. Deep down, hidden far away out of sight, all that seemed to him now, all his old past, his old thoughts, his old problems and theories, his old impressions, and that picture and himself and all. He felt as though he were flying upwards, and everything were vanishing from his sight. Making an unconscious movement with his hand, he suddenly became aware of the piece of money in his fist. He opened his hand, stared at the coin, and with a sweep of his arm flung it into the water. Then he turned and went home. It seemed to him he had cut himself off from everyone and from everything at that moment. Evening was coming on when he reached home, so that he must have been walking about 6 hours. How and where he came back he did not remember. Undressing and quivering like an overdriven horse, he lay down on the sofa, drew his great coat over him, and at once sank into oblivion. It was dusk when he was waked up by a fearful scream. Good God, what a scream!
such unnatural sounds, such howling, wailing, grinding, tears, blows, and curses he had never heard. He could never have imagined such brutality, such frenzy. In terror he sat up in bed, almost swooning with agony. But the fighting, wailing and cursing, grew louder and louder, and then, to his intense amazement, he caught the voice of his landlady. She was howling, shrieking and wailing, rapidly, hurriedly, incoherently, so that he could not make out what she was talking about. She was beseeching, no doubt, not to be beaten, for she was being mercilessly beaten on the stairs. The voice of her assailant was so horrible from spite and rage that it was almost a croak. But he, too, was saying something, and just as quickly and indistinctly hurrying and spluttering. All at once, Raskolnikov trembled. He recognized the voice. It was the voice of Ilya Petrovitch. Ilya Petrovitch here, and beating the landlady. He is kicking her, banging her head against the steps. That's clear, that can be told from the sounds, from the cries and the thuds. How is it? Is the world topsy-turvy? He could hear people running in crowds from all the stories and all the staircases. He heard voices, exclamations, knocking, doors banging. But why? Why? And how could it be, he repeated, thinking seriously, that he had gone mad? But no, he heard too distinctly. And they would come to him then next, for no doubt it's all about that, about yesterday. Good God! He would have fastened his door with a latch, but he couldn't lift his hand. Besides, it would be useless. Terror gripped his heart like ice, tortured him and numbed him. But at last all this uproar, after continuing about 10 minutes, began gradually to subside. The landlady was moaning and groaning. Ilya Petrovitch was still uttering threats and curses, but at last he, too, seemed to be silent, and now he could not be heard. Can he have gone away? Good Lord! Yes, and now the landlady is going, too, still weeping and moaning, and then her door slammed. Now the crowd was going from the stairs to their rooms, exclaiming, disputing, calling to one another, raising their voices to a shout, dropping them to a whisper. There must have been numbers of them, almost all the inmates of the block. But, good God, how could it be, and why? Why had he come here? Raskolnikov sank, worn out on the sofa, but could not close his eyes. He lay for half an hour in such anguish, such an intolerable sensation of infinite terror, as he had never experienced before. Suddenly, a bright light flashed into his room. Nastasya came in with a candle and a plate of soup. Looking at him carefully, and ascertaining that he was not asleep, she set the candle on the table and began to lay out what she had brought—bread, salt, a plate, a spoon. "You've eaten nothing since yesterday, I warrant. You've been trudging about all day, and you're shaking with fever." Nastasya! What were they beating the landlady for? She looked intently at him. "Who beat the landlady?" "Just now, half an hour ago. Ilya Petrovitch, the assistant superintendent, on the stairs. Why was he ill-treating her like that, and why was he here?" Nastasya scrutinized him, silent and frowning, and her scrutiny lasted a long time. He felt uneasy, even frightened at her searching eyes. "Nastasya, why don't you speak?" he said timidly at last in a weak voice. "It's the blood," she answered at last softly, as though speaking to herself. "Blood, what blood?" he muttered, growing white and turning towards the wall. Nastasya still looked at him without speaking. "Nobody has been beating the landlady," she declared at last in a firm, resolute voice. He gazed at her,
hardly able to breathe. I heard it myself. I wasn't asleep, I was sitting up. He said still more timidly. I listened a long while. The assistant superintendent came. Everyone ran out on the stairs from all the flats. No one has been here. That's the blood crying in your ears. When there's no outlet for it and it gets clotted, you begin fancying things. Will you eat something? He made no answer. Nastasya still stood over him, watching him. Give me something to drink, Nastasya. She went downstairs and returned with a white earthenware jug of water. He remembered only swallowing one sip of the cold water and spilling some on his neck. Then followed forgetfulness. Chapter 3. He was not completely unconscious, however, all the time he was ill. He was in a feverish state, sometimes delirious, sometimes half-conscious. He remembered a great deal afterwards. Sometimes it seemed as though there were a number of people around him. They wanted to take him away somewhere. There was a great deal of squabbling and discussing about him. Then he would be alone in the room. They had all gone away, afraid of him, and only now and then opened the door a crack to look at him. They threatened him, plotted something together, laughed, and mocked at him. He remembered Nastasya often at his bedside. He distinguished another person, too, whom he seemed to know very well, though he couldn't remember who he was, and this worried him, even made him cry. Sometimes he fancied he had been lying there a month. At other times it all seemed part of the same day. But of that, he had no recollection. And yet every minute he felt that he had forgotten something he ought to remember. He worried and tormented himself trying to remember, moaned, flew into a rage, or sank into awful, intolerable terror. Then he struggled to get up, would have run away, but someone always prevented him by force, and he sank back into impotence and forgetfulness. At last he returned to complete consciousness. It happened at 10 o'clock in the morning. On fine days the sun shone into the room at that hour, throwing a streak of light on the right wall and the corner near the door. Nastasya was standing beside him with another person, a complete stranger, who was looking at him very inquisitively. He was a young man with a beard, wearing a full, short-waisted coat, and looked like a messenger. The landlady was peeping in at the half-open door. Raskolnikov sat up. "Who is this, Nastasya?" he asked, pointing to the young man.
"Well, it looks like he's himself again," she said.
"He is himself," echoed the man. Concluding that he had returned to his senses, the landlady closed the door and disappeared. She was always shy and dreaded conversations or discussions. She was a woman of 40, not at all bad-looking, fat and buxom, with black eyes and eyebrows, good-natured from fatness and laziness, and absurdly bashful.
"Who are you?"
he went on, addressing the man. But at that moment the door was flung open, and, stooping a little, as he was so tall, Razumihin came in.
"What a cabin it is!" he cried. "I am always knocking my head. You call this a lodging? So you are conscious, brother. I've just heard the news from Pashinka."
"He has just come too," said Nastasya.
"Just come too,"
echoed the man again with a smile.
"And who are you?"
Razumihin asked, suddenly addressing him.
"My name is Vrazumihin, at your service. Not Razumihin, as I am always called, but Vrazumihin, a student and gentleman, and he is my friend. And who are you?"
I am the messenger from our office, from the merchant Shelopayev, and I've come on business.
Please sit down.
Razumihin seated himself on the other side of the table.
It's a good thing you've come too, brother, he went on to Raskolnikov. For the last 4 days you have scarcely eaten or drunk anything. We had to give you tea in spoonfuls. I brought Zosimov to see you twice. You remember Zosimov? He examined you carefully, and said at once it was nothing serious. Something seemed to have gone to your head. Some nervous nonsense, the result of bad feeding. He says you have not had enough beer and radish, but it's nothing much. It'll pass, and you'll be all right. Zosimov is a first-rate fellow. He's making quite a name. Come, I won't keep you, he said, addressing the man again. Will you explain what you want? You must know, Rodya, this is the second time they have sent from the office. But it was another man last time, and I talked to him. Who was it came before?
That was the day before yesterday, I venture to say. If you please, sir, that was Alexei Semyonovich. He is in our office, too.
He was more intelligent than you, don't you think so?
Yes, indeed, sir. He is of more weight than I am.
Quite so. Go on.
At your mama's request, through Afanasy Ivanovich Vakhrushin, of whom I presume you have heard more than once, a remittance is sent to you from our office, the man began, addressing Raskolnikov. If you are in an intelligible condition, I've 35 rubles to remit to you, because Semyon Semyonovich has received, from Afanasy Ivanovich, at your mama's request, instructions to that effect, as on previous occasions. Do you know him, sir?
Yes. I remember Vakhrushin,
Raskolnikov said dreamily.
You hear? He knows Vakhrushin, cried Razumihin. He is in an intelligible condition. And I see you are an intelligent man, too. Well, it's always pleasant to hear words of wisdom.
That's the gentleman, Vakhrushin, Afanasy Ivanovich. And, at the request of your mama, who has sent you a remittance once before, in the same manner, through him, he did not refuse this time also, and sent instructions to Semyon Semyonovich some days since to hand you 35 rubles in the hope of better to come.
That hoping for better to come is the best thing you've said, though your mama is not bad either. Come then, what do you say? Is he fully conscious, eh?
That's all right, if only he can sign this little paper.
He can scrawl his name. Have you got the book?
Yes, here's the book.
Give it to me. Here, Rodya, sit up. I'll hold you. Take the pen and scribble Raskolnikov for him. For just now, brother, money is sweeter to us than treacle.
I don't want it,
said Raskolnikov, pushing away the pen.
Not want it? I won't sign it.
How the devil can you do without signing it?
I don't want the money.
Don't want the money?
Come, brother, that's nonsense. I bear witness.
Don't trouble, please. It's only that he's wandering again, but that's pretty common with him at all times, though. You are a man of judgment, and we will take him in hand. That is, more simply, take his hand, and he will sign it. Here.
But I can come another time.
No, no. Why should we trouble you? You are a man of judgment.
Now, Rodya, don't keep your visitor. You see, he is waiting.
And he made ready to hold Raskolnikov's hand in earnest.
Stop. I'll do it alone,
said the latter, taking the pen and signing his name. The messenger took out the money and went away.
Bravo! And now, brother, are you hungry?
Yes,
answered Raskolnikov. Is there any soup?
Some of yesterday's, answered Nastasya, who was still standing there.
With potatoes and rice in it?
Yes.
I know it by heart. Bring soup and give us some tea.
Very well.
Raskolnikov looked at all this with profound astonishment and a dull, unreasoning terror. He made up his mind to keep quiet and see what would happen.
"I believe I am not wandering. I believe it's reality," he thought.
In a couple of minutes, Nastasya returned with the soup and announced that the tea would be ready directly. With the soup, she brought 2 spoons, 2 plates, salt, pepper, mustard for the beef, and so on. The table was set as it hadn't been for a long time. The cloth was clean.
"It wouldn't be amiss, Nastasya, if Praskovya Pavlovna were to send us up a couple of bottles of beer. We could empty them."
"Well, you are a cool hand," muttered Nastasya, and she departed to carry out his orders.
Raskolnikov still gazed wildly with strained attention. Meanwhile, Razumihin sat down on the sofa beside him, as clumsily as a bear put his left arm round Raskolnikov's head, although he was able to sit up, and with his right hand gave him a spoonful of soup, blowing on it that it might not burn him. But the soup was only just warm. Raskolnikov swallowed 1 spoonful greedily, then a second, then a third. But after giving him a few more spoonfuls of soup, Razumihin suddenly stopped and said that he should consult Zosimov whether he ought to have more. Nastasya came in with 2 bottles of beer.
"And will you have tea?"
"Yes."
"Go along, Nastasya, and bring some tea. I think we can have some tea without a medical consultation. But here is the beer."
He moved back to his chair, pulled the soup and meat in front of him, and began eating as though he had not touched food for 3 days.
"I must tell you, Rodya, I dine like this here every day now," he mumbled with his mouth full of beef. "And it's all Pashinka, your dear little landlady, who sees to that. She loves to do anything for me. I don't ask for it, but of course I don't object. And here's Nastasya with the tea. She's a quick girl. Nastasya, my dear, won't you have some beer?"
"Get along with your nonsense."
"A cup of tea, then?"
"A cup of tea, maybe."
"Pour it out. Stay, I'll pour it out myself. Sit down."
He poured out 2 cups, left his dinner, and sat on the sofa again. As before, he put his left arm round the sick man's head, raised him up, and gave him tea in spoonfuls, again blowing each spoonful steadily and earnestly, as though this process was the principal and most effective means towards his friend's recovery. Raskolnikov said nothing, and made no resistance, though he felt quite strong enough to sit up on the sofa without support, and couldn't merely have held a cup or a spoon, but even perhaps could have walked about. But from some queer, almost animal cunning, he conceived the idea of hiding his strength, and lying low for a time, pretending, if necessary, not to be yet in full possession of his faculties, and meanwhile listening to find out what was going on. Yet he could not overcome his sense of repugnance. After sipping 12 spoonfuls of tea, he suddenly released his head, pushed the spoon away capriciously, and sank back on the pillow. There were actually real pillows under his head now, down pillows in clean cases. He observed that, too, and took note of it.
"Pashinka must give us some raspberry jam today to make him some raspberry tea," said Razumihin, going back to his chair and attacking his soup and beer again.
"And where is she to get raspberries for you?" asked Nastasya, balancing a saucer on her 5 outspread fingers and sipping tea through a lump of sugar.
"She'll get it at the shop, my dear. You see, Rodya, all sorts of things have been happening while you've been laid up. When you decamped in that rascally way without leaving your address, I felt so angry that I resolved to find you out and punish you. I set to work that very day. How I ran about making inquiries for you! This lodging of yours I had forgotten, though I never remembered it, indeed, because I didn't know it. And as for your old lodgings, I could only remember it was at the 5 Corners, Kharlamov's house.
I kept trying to find that Khalomov's house, and afterwards it turned out that it was not Khalomov's house, but Buch's. Sometimes one mixes up the sounds. So I lost my temper, and I went on the chance to the address bureau next day, and only fancy, in 2 minutes, they looked you up. Your name is down there.
My name?
I should think so. And yet a General Kobolev they could not find while I was there. Well, it's a long story, but as soon as I did land on this place, I soon got to know all your affairs. All. All, brother. I know everything. Nastasya here will tell you. I made the acquaintance of Nikodim Fomich and Ilya Petrovich, and the house porter, and Mr. Zamyatov Alexander Grigorievich, the head clerk in the police office. And last, but not least, of Pashinka. Nastasya here knows.
He's got round her,
Nastasya murmured, smiling slyly.
Why don't you put the sugar in your tea, Nastasya Nikiforovna?
You are a one, Nastasya cried suddenly, going off into a giggle. I am not Nikiforovna, but Petrovna, she added suddenly, recovering from her mirth. I'll make a note of it. Well, brother, to make a long story short, I was going in for a regular explosion here to uproot all malignant influences in the locality, but Pashinka won the day. I had not expected, brother, to find her so prepossessing. Huh? What do you think? Raskolnikov did not speak, but he still kept his eyes fixed upon him, full of alarm. And all that could be wished,
indeed,
in every respect, Razumihin went on, not at all embarrassed by his silence.
Ah, the sly dog!
Nastasya shrieked again. This conversation afforded her unspeakable delight.
It's a pity, brother, that you did not set to work in the right way at first. You ought to have approached her differently. She's, so to speak, a most unaccountable character. But we'll talk about her character later. How could you let things come to such a pass that she gave up sending you your dinner? And that IOU? You must have been mad to sign an IOU. And that promise of marriage when her daughter, Natalia Yegorovna, was alive? I know all about it, but I see that's a delicate matter, and I am an ass. Forgive me. But, talking of foolishness, do you know Praskovya Pavlovna is not nearly so foolish as you would think at first sight?
No, mumbled Raskolnikov, looking away, but feeling that it was better to keep up the conversation.
She isn't, is she?
Cried Razumihin, delighted to get an answer out of him.
But she's not very clever either, huh?
She is essentially an unaccountable character. I am sometimes quite at a loss, I assure you.
She must be 40. She says she's 36, and of course she has every right to say so. But I swear I judge her intellectually, simply from the metaphysical point of view. There is a sort of symbolism sprung up between us, a sort of algebra, or what not. I don't understand it. Well, that's all nonsense. Only seeing that you are not a student now, and have lost your lessons and your clothes, and that through the young lady's death she has no need to treat you as a relation, she suddenly took fright. And as you hid in your den and dropped all your old relations with her, she planned to get rid of you. And she's been cherishing that design a long time, but was sorry to lose the IOU. For you assured her yourself that your mother would pay.
It was base of me to say that. My mother herself is almost a beggar.
And I told a lie to keep my lodging and be fed, Raskolnikov said loudly and distinctly. Yes, you did, very sensibly. But the worst of it is that at that point, Mr. Chebarov turns up, a businessman. Pashinka would never have thought of doing anything on her own account. She's too retiring. But the businessman is by no means retiring, and first thing he puts the question, is there any hope of realizing the IOU? Answer, there is.
because he has a mother who would save her Rodya with her 125 rubles pension if she has to starve herself, and a sister, too, who would go into bondage for his sake. That's what he was building upon.
Why do you start?
I know all the ins and outs of your affairs now, my dear boy. It's not for nothing that you were so open with Pashinka when you were her prospective son-in-law. And I say all this as a friend. But I tell you what it is. An honest and sensitive man is open. And a businessman listens and goes on eating you up. Well, then she gave the IOU by way of payment to this Chebarov, and without hesitation he made a formal demand for payment. When I heard of all this, I wanted to blow him up, too, to clear my conscience, but by that time harmony reigned between me and Pashinka, and I insisted on stopping the whole affair, engaging that you would pay. I went security for you, brother, do you understand? We called Chebarov, flung him 10 rubles, and got the IOU back from him. And here I have the honor of presenting it to you. She trusts your word now. Here, take it. You see, I have torn it.
Razumihin put the note on the table.
Raskolnikov looked at him and turned to the wall without uttering a word. Even Razumihin felt a twinge.
"I see, brother," he said a moment later, "that I have been playing the fool again. I thought I should amuse you with my chatter, and I believe I have only made you cross."
"Was it you I didn't recognize when I was delirious?" Raskolnikov asked, after a moment's pause without turning his head.
"Yes, and you flew into a rage about it, especially when I brought Zamyatov one day."
"Zamyatov? The head clerk, what for?"
Raskolnikov turned round quickly and fixed his eyes on Razumihin.
"What's the matter with you? What are you upset about? He wanted to make your acquaintance because I talked to him a lot about you. How could I have found out so much except from him? He's a capital fellow, brother, first rate. In his own way, of course. Now we're friends. See each other almost every day. I have moved into this part of town, you know. I've only just moved. I've been with him to Luisa Ivanovna once or twice. Do you remember Luisa? Luisa Ivanovna?"
Did I say anything in delirium?
"I should think so. You were beside yourself.
What did I rave about?
What next? What did you rave about? What people do rave about? Well, brother, now I must not lose time. To work."
He got up from the table and took up his cap.
"What did I rave about? How he keeps on. Are you afraid of having let out some secret? Don't worry yourself. You said nothing about a countess. But you said a lot about a bulldog, and about earrings and chains, and about Krestovsky Island and some porter, and Nikodim Fomich and Ilya Petrovich, the assistant superintendent. And another thing that was of special interest to you was your own sock. You whined, 'Give me my sock.' Zamyatov hunted all about your room for your socks, and with his own scented, ring-bedecked fingers, he gave you the rag. And only then were you comforted. And for the next 24 hours, you held the wretched thing in your hand. We couldn't get it from you. It's most likely somewhere under your quilt at this moment. And then you asked so piteously for a fringe for your trousers. We tried to find out what sort of fringe, but we couldn't make it out. Now, to business. Here are 35 rubles. I take 10 of them and shall give you an account of them in an hour or two. I will let Zosimov know at the same time, though he ought to have been here long ago, for it's nearly 12. And you, Nastasya, look in pretty often while I'm away to see whether he wants a drink or anything else. And I will tell Pashyenka what is wanted myself. Goodbye. He calls her Pashyenka. Oh, he's a smooth one, said Nastasya as he went out.
Then she opened the door and stood listening, but couldn't resist running downstairs after him. She was very eager to hear what he would say to the landlady. She was evidently